Additional Encore audio archive recordings are available at www.12steptapes.com. We request you not upload this recording to the major free outlets. We are happy to allow free listening on our own site with a subscription service. Contact us on www.12steptapes.com for more information.
Did you know that Miss Holland, aren't you August birthday also?
I only looked it up because of the kids.
There was a time that I thought, like there were maybe two different ones, because I'm like, oh, it's such a special person. How did I go to do this? I didn't know there were three. But you know, it makes sense.
Why does it make sense?
Because you're weird.
Because I'm a misfit.
I'm August, thank you very much.
Yeah, right.
You forgot. Good morning. Good morning. I'm the leader. I get to do that. Okay. You did everything but the, where is it? Where is the script? Script. I don't know. Most groups open with a moment of silence followed by serenity prayer. No.
Okay.
I think there's one more page. Let me look.
Did I take all of the script pages off of your desk? I may have. I took them all. I did take them all.
Just wait.
My fault. Hold on.
I could wing it, maybe.
You should be able to at this point.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I didn't want one, so she took them all.
I'm glad you pointed that out.
It's all my fault. One more time.
Thank you. Yes.
Okay, good.
It even has my name on it, so I know who I am. Okay, good morning. Let's start again. My name is Barbara Van Sliders, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Barbara.
I welcome you to a cultivating attitude of gratitude. Al-Anon closing meeting of the 48th annual San Fernando Valley AA convention with Al-Anon and Al-Anon participation. Before we begin, please turn off or silence your cell phones. Please stand and join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity
to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Okay. We welcome you to the 48th annual San Fernando Valley AA convention of Al-Anon ALT participation closing meeting, and hope you will find in this fellowship the help and friendship we have been privileged to enjoy. We who live or have lived with the problem of alcoholism understand, as perhaps few others can. We too are lonely and frustrated, but in Al-Anon ALT we discover that no situation is really hopeless, and that it is possible for us to find contentment and even happiness, whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. We urge you to try our program. It has helped many of us find solutions that lead us to serenity. So much depends on our own attitudes, and we learn to place our problem in its true perspective. We find it loses its power to dominate our thoughts and our lives. The family situation is bound to improve as we apply the Al-Anon Alateen ideas. Without such spiritual help, living with an alcoholic is too much for most of us. Our thinking becomes distorted by trying to force solutions, and we become irritable and unreasonable without knowing it. The Al-Anon Alateen program is based on the 12 steps adapted from the Alcoholics Anonymous, which we try little by little, one day at a time, to apply to our lives, along with the slogans and the Serenity Prayer. The loving interchange of help among members and daily reading of Al-Anon literature thus makes us ready to receive the priceless gift of serenity. Anonymity is an important principle of the Al-Anon Alateen program. Everything that is said here, in the group meeting, and member to member must be held in confidence. Only in this way can we feel free to say what is in our minds and hearts, for this is how we help one another in Al-Anon. Okay. The Al-Anon family groups are a fellowship of relatives and friends of alcoholics who share their experience, strength, and hope in order to solve these common problems. We believe alcoholism is a family illness and that changed attitudes can aid recovery. Al-Anon is not allied with any sect or denomination, political entity, organization, or institution. Does not engage in any controversy, either endorses nor opposes any cause. There are no dues for membership. Al-Anon is self-supporting through its own voluntary contributions. Al-Anon has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing 12 steps, by welcoming and giving comfort to families of alcoholics, and by giving understanding and encouragement to the alcoholic. Lori A. The 12 steps.
That's Carol.
Okay. I asked Carol to come up and read the 12 steps.
Thank you. Yay. Hello, everyone. My name is Carol. I'm a grateful Al-Anon.
Carol.
12 steps. Because of their proven power and worth, AA's 12 steps have been adopted almost word for word by Al-Anon. They represent a way of life appealing to all people of goodwill, of any religious faith, or of none. Note the power of the very words. 1. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. Were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9. Made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry the message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Thank you.
Okay, and the 12 traditions will be read by Miss Renee. Let's see here.
Pieces of paper.
Hi, I'm Renee.
Hi, Renee.
morning, everyone, except for the heckler. 12 traditions. The traditions that follow bind us together in unity. They guide us, they guide the groups in their relations with other groups, with AA and the outside world. They recommend group attitudes towards leadership, membership, money, property, public relations, and anonymity. The traditions evolved from the experience of AA groups in trying to solve their problems of living and working together. Al-Anon adopted these group guidelines and over the years has found them sound and wise. Although they are only suggestions, Al-Anon's unity and perhaps even its survival are dependent on adherence to these principles. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal progress for the greatest number depends upon unity. 2. For our group purpose, there's but one authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The relatives of alcoholics, when gathered together for mutual aid, may call themselves an Al-Anon family group, provided that, as a group, they have no other affiliation. The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or friend. 4. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting another group or Al-Anon or AA as a whole. 5. Each Al-Anon family group has but one purpose, to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps of AA ourselves, by encouraging and understanding our alcoholic relatives, and by welcoming and giving comfort to families of alcoholics. 6. Our family...
Hi everybody, my name is Barry Bucknum. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Barry. Hey.
Welcome to the San Fernando Valley AA convention with Al-Anon and Al-Anon participation closing meeting. Well, first I want to thank Heather and the committee for asking me. It really wasn't an ask, but I was told. to be the closing speaker. It's been a great convention. I'm a past chair for 2015. And Karen, welcome to the Has-Been Club. And so, here it all goes. I don't know why I'm nervous, but I'm always nervous. I'm going to share my experience, strength, and hope, and hopefully you guys hear something. Hope for today, on gratitude, May 30th, first sentence in it says, I am grateful for the many blessings that have come my way since I joined Al-Anon. My gratitude is reflected in my attitude toward the life today. In fact, I feel great. I am full of joy, and at the recent meeting on gratitude, I stated, I surely would like to know why the word grateful is spelled that way. I really feel grateful. Many have not, you know, and so I am really grateful for this, for the life that I have today, the life I had. Before wasn't the greatest. I did not grow up in alcoholism. I grew up in a dysfunctional family. My father was a compulsive gambler and a womanizer, and until the day he died, and my mother was an untreated Al-Anon. I am one of three. There are now two of us left. My brother passed away 9 years ago. And in our religion, the firstborn is the prince. My father was the first son to his parents. My father was the prince in his family, and he was enabled in everything he did, from what I understand. My grandfather was always bailing him out. My mom grew up in a very loving home, and she was the youngest, and she had an older sister who was 10 years older than her. And I think, I never got the full story from my mother. My mother passed away 3 years ago. I think that my mom was looking to get out of where she lived. And she was looking to get a better life than what she had. Because my grandparents raised her with the old stand, you know, she grew up at the end of the Depression. And they had just enough to live. They had a modest lifestyle. And I think my mom was always reaching for more. And my dad, you know, her best friend was dating my father. And my dad was good looking. And she saw my dad, met my dad, and stole my dad from her friend. That I know. Then my mom got pregnant with my brother before she got married, and our life journey started. My brother was the firstborn, and he became the new prince. And then 3 years later, I showed up. And then 18 months later, my little sister showed up, and I was disappeared. And my dad's parents, my grandmother, was very judgmental. You know, in our reading, Understanding Ourselves, you know, it states being unwanted, unloved, and alone. And that's how I grew up, being unwanted, unloved, and alone. I was never seen in my house. I was brought up in the 60s. So it was like, we were brought up to be, children were to be seen and not heard. And that was a definite in my house. My parents had lots of parties. There was always alcohol, but it was always cleaned up. We had a bar, but the bottles were dusty. So my parents didn't drink, but they there was always card games in my house. And then, and that's what my dad did. My dad played cards. And so, So my grandmother, my dad's mom, she was judgmental, as his aunt was, my grandfather's sister. And my grandmother, if she weighed over an ounce, over 100 pounds, she was fat. And I was a chubby kid. So why didn't I look the way she wanted me to look? My brother was, like I said, the prince. My sister was the cute little sister. And so it was like, why aren't I as cute as my sister? Why aren't I like my brother? And nobody accepted me for me. So I never knew who I was. So found out recently, I was going to therapy for a while, and I found out from my therapist that I was living the Cinderella syndrome, and that I was, you know, and Cinderella was my favorite movie growing up. I loved Leslie Ann Warren. I wanted to be Cinderella. I wanted to find that Prince Charming. I wanted to go off into the sunset and just be happy ever after. You know, and that's what I dreamt of. I mean, when I would go to sleep, I dreamt of my wedding. I was at the top of a staircase, walking down that spiral staircase with this beautiful Cinderella gown and all this. So that's what I dreamt of. You know, I thought I wanted to be, I knew I wanted to be a princess. And so my dad put two houses into foreclosure. We moved. When my brother had his bar mitzvah, my mother redid our guest room, and he got a new room, and I got his. And that was my life. I got his hand-me-downs. I got his Hang 10 t-shirts. I got his corduroy jeans. I got all of his clothes, and, it was like living hand-me-downs, So it's like so you get the Cinderella syndrome, right? So I went to summer school that after that year. This is in 1970, right after the earthquake, so that was 71. And walking home from school, from summer school, and our house, I had just got my own room. I'd been sharing a room with my little sister. Just got my own room. House is up for sale. Didn't know we were selling our house. And the house was already sold. And I was like, wow, I just got my own room. I just started to be able to have my stuff, and it was taken away from me. Ended up moving into a smaller home, sharing a room with my sister again. And, my Al-Anonism started when I was about 11 years old, when we moved into that second house. And my mom went to work for the first time. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. And she went to work, and I was put in charge. She would leave notes, and it was like, this is what's for dinner, this is what's in the refrigerator, this is how you make it, make sure your sister does her homework, do your homework, make sure the kitchen is clean, make sure the laundry is put away, this laundry list of what I needed to do. And so I started taking care of my little sister. And my little sister didn't want me to take care of her. To this day, my little sister doesn't want me to take care of her. And I'll get into that later. But, I would get pissed off. And I'd get on my bike. And we lived near a park. And I would ride my bike to the park. And there were huge storm drains in the park. And I would sit in those storm drains. And I would sing, "Everybody hates me, nobody loves me. I'm gonna eat those worms." Until I felt a little bit better, and I ride my bike out back home. I was always trying to fill that heart out, that my hole up in my heart. My dad was in and out of our lives from the time I was 8 until I was 16. My mom constantly took him back. Revolving door in my house. Didn't know if my dad was home, didn't know if my dad was there. We looked wonderful on the outside, but chaos on the inside. I remember when we lived in this house, my mom was at work, my dad wasn't living with us at the time, and these men come knocking at our door, and my brother's room was right near our front door, and we were told if anybody knocked on the door, you look out the window, because we were latchkey kids. And so it was just me and my sister. My brother had gone off doing whatever he did. And I looked out the room, out my brother's window, and there were these two men, and I slid the window open, and it's like, I said, "Hello?" And it's like, they asked for my dad. I said, "My dad's not here." And, and all of a sudden they pull their jacket open, and I see guns, and they're, I found out later that the mob or whoever these men were looking for my dad for money that he, So fear, chaos is what I grew up with. And just, and I wanted my dad to love me, but my dad didn't love me. He couldn't love me. I don't know why, but my dad didn't love me. So I started dating at a young age. I joined a youth group, met a boy. I think I was in eighth grade. And he didn't want, we dated for a little bit, and then it was like, date a couple of weeks. I thought it was dating. And so I always had somebody on the back, in the background. It's like, I'll date you, but you're cute. I'll wait for you until your time is ready. So I was always taking guys hostage, until I got tired of them. And then I was engaged to be married at the end of my senior year of high school, and he came to my mom's apartment, and I just graduated and just turned 18, and he said to me, "You're going to be going off to college, I was going to go to Valley College. And he said, you're going to meet other people. Maybe we should take a break so you make sure that this is right. You know, and it's like I told him, I said, no, I said, I don't want to do that. And he goes, well, no, I think we should do that. And I said, well, then if we're doing it, goodbye, so long, farewell, I'll find somebody else. So I got a job, didn't go to college. Well, I went to college for 2 weeks and got a failing grade, and that was my history. It's like, you know, I wasn't a great student. And so I stopped going to school. Got a job, was working at Sears over at Northridge Mall, which is now where the parking lot is after the earthquake. And it was my very first day at work. I worked in the garden department. And this, you know, I'm 18, this old man walks in, you know, and he's like going, I need steer manure. And it's like, I'm going, well, I'm a princess. I'm sorry, I don't do those things. You know, and so I showed him where it was, and he comes back and he says, I forgot how many bags, but he wanted me to put him in his car. Well, I'm sorry, I don't do that. So I scanned the room. The catalog department was in this building, and at that time, Ticketron, which is now, what, Ticketmaster, I think, you know, because we didn't buy tickets online then. We didn't have computers, really, you know. And so I'm scanning. I see this guy sitting over at Ticketron. He was cute. I could talk to him. So I saunter over there, bat my eyes a little bit, and go, can you help me, please? Damsel in distress, can you help me, please? And he was very gracious and said he would help. And that was 46 years ago I met this guy. We dated. And, you know, I should have had a clue because our first date, we go out, we go to a movie out in Westwood, go and it takes me out to dinner, and, you know, we did what kids do back in, you know, when you're dating, you know, it's like we went up and parked and went and looked at the stars, right? And he said, we're going, well, let's go on a picnic tomorrow. I said, sure, we'll go on a picnic tomorrow. I'll make you some chocolate chip cookies. He goes, okay. He doesn't tell me that he had to take his parents down to Laguna for his nephew's baptism. And I'm waiting. No phone call, no nothing, until I think maybe it was late that evening. I don't remember. But we didn't go on the picnic. The chocolate chip cookies were made. Next day, you know, it's like, he tells me, goes, oh, I had to take my parents down to Laguna. Now this is a funny story, right? I wasn't happy. I should have said, oh, fine, leave me alone, go away. I don't want you. But I stuck around with him because he was fun. He was exciting, you know? And so we went on our journey, and we would party, and we would drink, and I would, you know, and then I don't have the disease of alcoholism. I didn't know that he did, you know. 2 years later, we get married. And, you know, my head would, you know, it's like, I want things that are better. If I have better things, my life will be better. You know, he grew up in a house. I grew up in a couple of homes and then an apartment. And I didn't want to live in an apartment anymore. I wanted the house. He did tell me, before we got married, because I was still working retail, I needed to get a real job if we were going to get married. And it's like, okay, well, I need to get out of my mom's house, and I need to get a real job. So I got a job working for a mortgage company. It was a real job. And so I worked at this mortgage company until we got married, and then I went and worked for Countrywide Mortgage. And we're working for Countrywide, and I wanted a house. And so in 1980, when the rates were skyrocketing, we found a house and I processed my own loan, and I saw the rates going up, and I kept my mouth shut because I wanted a house until we signed the papers. And he looks at it and he goes, what's going on? And I go, don't worry, it's fine. We're going, you know, and we bought that house. We lived in that house for almost a year because we couldn't afford it, you know, and we sold that house. But in the meantime, he went back to school, and in this house, we were at the very last track. We lived out in Canyon Country. We were at the very last track, and he was right. He had a motorcycle, and we had a car. We both worked in the San Fernando Valley, and then we would drive back to Canyon Country. And he was going to school. He was on his bike. And I knew about what time he got home on the nights he went to school. And it's 12 o'clock. He's not home yet. It's 1 o'clock. He's not home yet. And there's no street, there's no street lights on this, on our street. I hit this and sparks. That's good. Good watchdog. And so I'm calling my mama. And I'm crying on the phone. It's like, he's on his bike. He's dead somewhere. What's going on? You know, all that. And it's like, and I'm like, you know, and so it's like, she's talking me down. And then I invited a friend over who is like a big brother to me. We always went over to his house. We would party with him. He came up and, you know, my husband gets home. And he's pissed because this guy is at our house and he's not here. And found out later in life why he was so upset about it, but not at that time. You know, and, you know, that fear that, you know, he's drinking, he's riding a motorcycle, he's not home, he's dead. I wanted him to die then because I was like, I'm done, but I didn't, you know. So we sold that house. And I thought, maybe if we have a baby, our life would be better. Shush. You know, and so we sold that house. We rented a little house on a duplex. And I stopped drinking because I was pregnant, but he kept on drinking. And our son was born in October. And he was also smoking cigarettes and drinking, you know. And I told him, oh, you can't smoke in the house. So he stopped smoking. So I thought, well, maybe if I tell him he can drink out of that, he can't drink in the house, he'd stop drinking. And that didn't work. You know, and so then, you know, it was like, I would make dinner. I had the bar number in my phone book, and I knew where he was. And, you know, it's like I would make dinner, and he wasn't home from work. I would call the bar up, which was down the street from where he worked. And is he there? And he said, no, he's not here. I knew he was there. And I would put our son in his car seat, and we'd drive down to where he worked, got to the bar. He would be there with his friends from work, and one of the people that he would drink with was this woman who happened to be our son's godmother. I got my son in my arms. I hand it to her, who's been drinking, and take my husband outside and tell him that we need to get home, you know. And it's like, this ain't happening. And, you know, it's like, and that, you know, I think about this today. It's like, why would I give my son to somebody who's been drinking? You know, it's like, that's totally insanity. You know, but I needed to take care of things. So when our son was 6 months old, we were at his parents' house, and this house was up for sale next door, and his dad, I mean, it's a huge long story, but that's another story, but it's like, his dad's best friend built this house. And I'd heard the stories, and it's like, well, we need to buy that house. We walked in and looked, let's buy this house. So we bought that house. And we had another kid. And life was still crazy, you know? It's like the first 15 years of our marriage was active alcoholism, and we raised these two boys in active alcoholism. While living in this house, we would have many, many arguments. I would yell, I'd be screaming, I'd get pissed off, because my habit of when I was growing up, I would storm off, My mother used to tell me when I get upset with her and I'd storm off, she used to call me Groucho because I would walk like Groucho Marx did. You know, it's like, she'd call me Groucho. And I would, or she would be chasing me down the hallway with a hairbrush, you know, and I would slam my bedroom door and stand behind the bedroom door and go, I'm never going to be like my mom. I'm never going to be like my mom. And when we got married, I told myself, I am not going to end up like my mom. So it's my power that I will do everything in my power to make my marriage work. I will do everything in my power to make my life work. And in the new reader, A Little Time for Myself, on April 7th, there is a couple of sayings in here that I practice other steps, the first three steps. I practice other steps. I can, I will, watch me do it. And that's what my life was like, watch me do it. And so when we would have arguments, I would yell, I would scream, I would threaten. I threatened the D word I don't know how many times. And I would get in our car and I would storm out of that car, just screech out our driveway. We lived on a busy street. And my head was like going, if I die, if I get killed, he will really miss me. And he'll realize how much he had missed, because how much I took care of everything. And now he's got to take care of these two kids, and I'm not there to do it. I would go and stand in the middle of the street hoping that somebody would hit me, and that would end my misery. And so one night we got into it, and I was eating a banana. I found out that a banana is a weapon. And so I took that banana and I chucked it at him. And he ducked and broke my kitchen window. And he boarded up the kitchen window. And my kitchen window looked out to our front street. And it's like, now I have to do the dishes with this window boarded up, because he wasn't going to fix it. Until I learned my lesson. I don't know. Finally got fixed, but we'd moved again. I wanted to live in suburbia. I wanted my kids to be able to ride their bikes around, because we lived on a busy street. So we moved to suburbia, and we went and checked this neighborhood out in Simi Valley, and we checked this neighborhood out, and it was, kids were out playing and stuff, but they were in school during the week. And I had a two-year-old, and I had a kid in kindergarten, and it's like, now my two-year-old has nobody to play with. You know, and it was dead quiet, because Simi, I didn't know this, but Simi Valley is like a bedroom community, you know, and I didn't know that. So there were no moms around, there was nobody around, you know, so I'm isolated one more time, you know, and so it was just, you know, so we decided in 1988, I was fed up. I was fed up with my life. And my brother's best friend, who we grew up across the street from, he taught me how to ride my bike. He taught me how to swim. You know, his family was great. There was a family I wanted to live with when I was a little girl. And so he was an MFT, and I gave him a call, and I said to him, I said, what am I supposed to do? I don't know what to do. I'm scared. I don't know what to do. And he told me, he goes, well, I can't help you because I'm too close. You know, he goes, you need to find a marriage therapist. And I'm giving you a number. And he gave me a number for AA. And I was like, well, I don't drink. Why do I need that number? And so I called it, and I told them, I said, my husband's drinking is bothering me. My life is miserable. I don't know what to do. And they said, well, here, call this number. And it was Al-Anon. I thought, well, I'm not going to do that. So I found the therapist. I told him, I said, we need to go to marriage therapy. We went. The therapist told us that he needed to go to AA and I needed to go to Al-Anon. So we listened. We did. I went to an Al-Anon meeting. I didn't hear a word you guys said to me. I saw chaos. I saw women smoking cigarettes. I saw kids running around because I guess there was supposed to be an Alateen meeting there and there wasn't. And it's like, my life is crazy. Why do I need this? You know, it's like, I don't need this. So it's like, bye-bye. And so I didn't go back. But he stuck with AA for almost a year. And during that time, I think it was during that time, or maybe it was before that, I can't remember anymore, but I kicked him out of the house. And, you know, and so he came back, I took him back, and we decided, we had bought a cabin up in Big Bear, and we decided that we're going to sell our house, and we're going to move up to Big Bear, and our life is going to be better. We're going to buy houses, cabins, and we're going to flip them, and we're going to do all this stuff, and we're going to make money, and our life is going to be better. And that didn't happen because the recession hit. And, you know, nobody's going to buy a house, a second house, when they can't afford a first one. And we tried finding work up there, and that didn't happen. And he was adding on to our little 600-square-foot cabin to make it better for us to live in. And life was going crazier and crazier. I found a doctor up there. He thought I had bronchitis. He kept treating me for bronchitis. You know, this is how my God works in my life. When we moved up to Big Bear in 1990, my oldest son was in Scouts, and he had to bake, you know, they make the egg drop thing, box and stuff, where you have to, they pull it up and they drop right so the egg drop. And I told him we were going to go down to Victorville to go buy school supplies. And if he hadn't, if it was not finished, he couldn't go. And, you know, and I always did things like that. I would tell him, it's like, I would set that boundary and I would cross it out. It's like, there is no boundary. And like, okay, fine. You whine and cry enough, you're going to go. So the way my higher power works in my life, he didn't finish it. I made him stay home. I stuck to my guns. So our little one, who was, I think, maybe not quite five, he and I went down. We're coming up because he was a good little boy. I bought him a couple of Ninja Turtles. And I had a Jeep. And we're driving back up, and I'm making a turn. He goes, Mommy, look at this. And I looked, and I overturned and overcompensated my turn, and I flipped our Jeep. And it rolled up a hill, not down a hill, because I'm still here. The top of the Jeep caved in, and if I had both my kids in the car, one of them would not be here today. That is how my higher power works for me. My son and I walked away with that from that accident without a scratch on us. You know, and it's like, I didn't see anything. I just, you know, it's like, I don't see my higher power yet. We moved back down to the San Fernando Valley, moved into his parents' house in Northridge, and we decided to go away for a weekend, just the two of us, try to get our lives back into order. And it took every ounce of energy that I had to walk up a flight of stairs, to walk from the hotel to the beach. And my husband said to me, because you need to go to the doctor when you get back to work, tomorrow, whatever. And I went to work, and I called I made an appointment for my lunch hour. I didn't go back to work. They put me in the hospital. They thought I had pneumonia. And so this is how my higher power works in my life. Found out I had cancer. If we were still up on that mountain without any medical insurance, we would have lost everything. I am grateful that my husband got a job before we moved back down there. That doctor, that oncologist, told me with the drugs that they were giving for chemotherapy, we would have less than a 1% chance to have another child. We had two healthy boys. I said, fine, that's great. We have a 29-year-old today. A little girl we were blessed with. That child was a thorn in my side from the day I conceived her. I used to say she was my alcoholic in training when I'd be at meetings. You know, and this is how my higher power works in my life today. She's a beautiful, mature young lady today. She's not that thorn in my side anymore. She talks to me today. You know, I wanted a little girl who I can play dolls with. I wanted a little girl who I can bake with. I wanted a little girl that I can dress up with in pretty clothes. I didn't get that little girl. I got a tomboy. That little girl, she's 12 years younger than my eldest, and she's 9 years younger than my eldest. Let's back up. She's 12 years younger than my oldest son, and she's 9 years younger than our middle son. My middle son, he is the perfect Al-Anon. He wears that badge of honor on his forehead. You know, and when the doctor told me, he goes, we're going to do a Schedule C step, and sorry, she's testing me. when I found I was pregnant with her, the OB said, we're going to do a scheduled C-section. And I said, okay. He goes, we'll deliver on August 9th. I said, no, we delivered one on August 9th already. That was almost 8.5 years ago, 8 years ago, whatever time frame was, it's my pregnancy. And he goes, okay, we'll do it on the 11th of August. I said, okay. Well, she showed up on the 2nd. You know, and my son holds that to her. Oh wow, holds that to her to this day. You know, it's like he took his babyhood away, made him the middle child, and his life is miserable. You know, and I have learned today that I try to do things. I used to try to do things for him, and now I don't. He left. He moved. He stopped talking to us. He moved out of our house when he was 18, and he refused to talk to us. You know, and we found out where he was, and I knew he was safe. And you guys told me, continue doing the things that I did before. Keep the doors open for him. And I did that. I walked back into these rooms in 2000. I walked into an Al-Anon meeting in 1995 or so when my daughter was little, and I couldn't keep her quiet in that room. And I went back to that meeting in 2000 when she was in kindergarten. And I thought you guys were gonna judge me because I walked out of that room with this, you know, I didn't do what I was told to do. Didn't put her in the babysitting room, didn't do any of that stuff. You know, and it's like, my head says, well, you guys haven't seen me in 5 years, and you're going to still remember that I was that mom. And you're going to, it's like, well, why didn't she do that? But you guys didn't do that. You guys embraced me, and you told me to keep coming back, and you guys loved on me until I can love myself. I found, this meeting had a speaker meeting, and I found a sponsor of that meeting. I wanted somebody who was married. I wanted somebody that had kids. I want somebody that can understand me. You know, and she did. Until she didn't. And I was afraid that if I told her that I didn't want our lives to be a sponsorship life, and we had become friends, that we would not be friends anymore. Because I was starting to have friends in these rooms. I didn't have friends growing up. You know, and we're still best friends today, you know, and I'm grateful for that. I am grateful for my life today. I am grateful that I have a partner in life We both work our programs the best that we can. We laughed today. You know, we'd moved up to that cabin up in Big Bear. You know, and it's like, it's okay. It's not great. It's okay. You know, but it's not my forever home. I don't know about him, but it's not my forever home. You know, and, you know, we're making plans, you know, and we're traveling, and we're doing things that we want to do. You know, and we couldn't have done that if our lives had stayed the way they were. You know, I don't know if I'd still be married. Like I said, I was not going to end up like my mom. I did not want to be divorced. I did not want that. You know, and so I am grateful that I have a marriage today. You know, we celebrated 44 years last June, and you know, it's one day at a time, and that's what I've learned in these rooms. It's one day at a time. I go to Zoom meetings, and I heard a friend on the Zoom meeting say, her sponsor told her, look at your toenails, paint your toenails, and look at your toenails. Where are your feet? You know, and if I look at my toes, and what color are they, you know, where are my feet? And I have to remember that. Today I have a little bit of struggles. You know, I've got a 41-year-old son and he's married, and my daughter-in-law don't see eye to eye. But I shared that marathon meeting that last night, and it's like, I have to remember it's his life, it's not my life. And I can have hope that maybe one day my daughter-in-law and I will see eye to eye, or somewhat, that we can be in the same room and I won't be pissed off at her. We're going up to Washington. We're going to be grandparents again. We have a beautiful 2.5-year-old granddaughter right now, and she's going to be a big sister in a couple of weeks. You know, and it was crazy trying to figure out how we're going to do this, because my son and my daughter-in-law have rules, and they're not my rules. You know, my mom may not have been the best mom, but she was a fantastic grandmother. And that's what I saw, and that's what I wanted to be. And I can't be that, grandmother that I wanted to be. And maybe this is the grandmother I'm supposed to be. I haven't figured that one out yet. And I'm gonna wrap up. Okay. And you know, and I'm not the grandmother that I want to be, you know, but, you know, I can be the best grandmother that those girls can have, and that maybe one day when they get older that they know that they can talk to me and reach out to me. I can try to be the best mom and the best mother-in-law, and hopefully one day that they will be the kind of, he'll be the son that he used to be, you know, but that's not today. And that's what I have to remember. That's not today. And I am just grateful that I'm here. I am grateful for my life today. And thank you for letting me share a little bit of experience, strength, and hope. I'm sorry it wasn't funny, but I'm not a funny person. Thank you.